D is for Deadbeat by Sue Grafton. Copyright 1987 by Sue Grafton. This book is read by Mary Pfeiffer. Chapter 1. Later, I found out his name was John Daggett, but that's not how he introduced himself the day he walked into my office. Even at the time, I sensed that something was off, but I couldn't figure out what it was. The job he hired me to do seemed simple enough, but then the bum tried to stiff me for my fee. When you're self-employed, you can't afford to let these things slide. Word gets out, and first thing you know, everybody thinks you can be had. I went after him for the money, and the next thing I knew, I was caught up in events I still haven't quite recovered from. My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private investigator, licensed by the state of California, operating a small office in Santa Teresa, which is where I've lived all my 32 years. I'm female, self-supporting, single now, having been married and divorced twice. I confess I'm sometimes testy, but for the most part I credit myself with an easygoing disposition, tempered, perhaps, by an exaggerated desire for independence. I'm also plagued with the sort of doggedness that makes private investigation a viable proposition for someone with a high school education, certification from the police academy, and a constitutional inability to work for anyone else. I pay my bills on time, obey most laws, and I feel that other people should do likewise, out of courtesy, if nothing else. I'm a purist when it comes to justice, but I'll lie at the drop of a hat. Inconsistency has never troubled me. It was late October, the day before Halloween, and the weather was mimicking autumn in the Midwest, clear and sunny and cool. Driving into town, I could have sworn I smelled wood smoke in the air, and I half expected the leaves to be turning yellow and rust. All I actually saw were the same old palm trees, the same relentless green everywhere. The fires of summer had been contained, and the rains hadn't started yet. It was a typical California unseason, but it felt like fall, and I was responding with inordinate good cheer, thinking maybe I'd drive up the pass in the afternoon to the pistol range, which is what I do for laughs. I'd come into the office that Saturday morning to take care of some bookkeeping chores, paying personal bills, getting out my statements for the month. I had my calculator out, a ready receipt form in the typewriter, and four completed statements lined up, addressed and stamped on the desk to my left. I was so intent on the task at hand that I didn't realize anyone was standing in the doorway until the man cleared his throat. I reacted with one of those little jumps you do when you open the evening paper and a spider runs out. He apparently found this amusing, but I was having to pat myself on the chest to get my heart rate down again. "I'm Alvin Lamardo," he said. "Sorry if I startled you." "That's all right," I said. "I just had no idea you were standing there. Are you looking for me?" "If you're Kinsey Milhone, I am." I got up and shook hands with him across the desk and then suggested that he take a seat. My first fleeting impression had been that he was a derelict, but on second glance I couldn't find anything in particular to support the idea. He was in his 50s, too gaunt for good health. His face was long and narrow, his chin pronounced, his hair was an ash gray, clipped short, and he smelled of citrus cologne. His eyes were hazel, his gaze remote. The suit he wore was an odd shade of green. His hands seemed huge, fingers long and bony, the knuckles enlarged. The 2 inches of narrow wrist extending, cuffless from his coat sleeves, suggested shabbiness, though his clothing didn't really look worn. He held a slip of paper which he'd folded twice, and he fiddled with that self-consciously. "What can I do for you?" I asked.
"I'd like for you to deliver this."
He smoothed out the piece of paper then and placed it on my desk. It was a cashier's check drawn on a Los Angeles bank, dated October 29th, and made out to someone named Tony Gayen for $25,000. I tried not to appear as surprised as I felt. He didn't look like a man with money to spare. Maybe he'd borrowed the sum from Gayen and was paying it back.
"You want to tell me what this is about?" "He did me a favor. I want to say thanks. That's all it is."
"It must have been quite a favor," I said. "Do you mind if I ask what he did?"
"He showed me a kindness when I was down on my luck."
"What do you need me for?" He smiled briefly.
"An attorney would charge me $120 an hour to handle it. I'm assuming you'd charge considerably less."
"So would a messenger service," I said. "It's cheaper still if you do it yourself."
I wasn't being a smart mouth about it. I really didn't understand why he needed a private detective. He cleared his throat.
I tried that, but I'm not entirely certain of Mr. Gahan's current address. At one time he lived on Stanley Place, but he's not there now. I went by this morning and the house is empty. It looks like it hasn't been lived in for a while. I want someone to track him down and make sure he gets the money. If you can estimate what that might run me, I'll pay you in advance.
That depends on how elusive Mr. Gahan turns out to be. The credit bureau might have a current address or the DMV. A lot of inquiries can be done by phone, but they still take time. At $30 an hour, the fee does mount up. He took out a checkbook and began to write out a check.
$200?
Let's make it four. I can always refund the balance if the charges turn out to be less, I said. In the meantime, I've got a license to protect, so this better be on the up and up. I'd be happier if you'd tell me what's going on.
This was where he hooked me, because what he said was just offbeat enough to be convincing. Liar that I am, it still didn't occur to me that there could be so much falsehood mixed in with the truth.
I got into trouble with the law a while back and served some time. Tony Gahan was helpful to me just before I was arrested. He had no idea of my circumstances, so he wasn't an accessory to anything, nor would you be. I feel indebted.
Why not take care of it yourself?
He hesitated, almost shyly, I thought.
It's sort of like that Charles Dickens book, Great Expectations. He might not like having a convicted felon for a benefactor. People have strange ideas about ex-cons.
What if he won't accept an anonymous donation?
You can return the check in that case, and keep the fee.
I shifted restlessly in my chair. What's wrong with this picture, I asked myself. Where'd you get the money if you've been in jail?
Santa Anita. I'm still on parole, and I shouldn't be playing the ponies at all, but I find it hard to resist. That's why I'd like to pass the money on to you. I'm a gambling man. I can't have that kind of cash around, or I'll piss it away, if you'll pardon my French.
He closed his mouth then and looked at me, waiting to see what else I might ask. Clearly he didn't want to volunteer more than was necessary to satisfy my qualms, but he seemed amazingly patient. I realized later, of course, that his tolerance was probably the function of his feeding me so much bullshit. He must have been entertained by the game he was playing. Lying is fun. I can do it all day myself.
What was the felony? I asked.
He dropped his gaze, addressing his reply to his oversized hands, which were folded in his lap.
I don't think that pertains. This money is clean, and I came by it honestly. There's nothing illegal about the transaction, if that's what's worrying you.
Of course it worried me, but I wondered if I was being too fastidious. There was nothing wrong with his request on the face of it. I chased the proposition around in my head with caution, wondering what Tony Gahan had done for Limardo that would net him this kind of payoff. None of my business, I supposed, as long as no laws had been broken in the process. Intuition was telling me to turn this guy down, but it happens that the rent on my apartment was due the next day. I had the money in my checking account, but it seemed providential to have a retainer drop in my lap unexpectedly. In any event, I didn't see a reason to refuse.
All right, I said.
He nodded once, pleased.
Good.
I sat and watched while he finished signing his name to the check. He tore it out and pushed it toward me, tucking the checkbook into the inner pocket of his suit coat.
My address and telephone number are on that, in case you need to get in touch.
I pulled a standard contract form out of my desk drawer and took a few minutes to fill it in. I got his signature, and then I made a note of Tony Gahan's last known address, a house in Colgate, the township just north of Santa Teresa. I was already feeling some low-level dread, wishing I hadn't agreed to do anything. Still, I'd committed myself, the contract was signed, and I figured I'd make the best of it. How much trouble could it be, thought I. He stood up and I did too, moving with him as he walked toward the door. With both of us on our feet, I could see how much taller he was than I. Maybe 6'4" to my 5'6". He paused with his hand on the knob, gazing down at me with the same remote stare.
"One other thing you might need to know about Tony Gahan," he said.
"What's that?"
"He's 15 years old."
I stood there and watched Alvin Limardo move off down the hall. I should have called him back, folks. I should have known right then that it wasn't going to turn out well. Instead, I closed the office door and returned to my desk. On impulse, I opened the French doors and went out on the balcony. I scanned the street below, but there was no sign of him. I shook my head, dissatisfied. I locked the cashier's check in my file cabinet, When the bank opened on Monday, I'd put it in my safe deposit box until I located Tony Gahan and then turn it over to him. 15? At noon, I closed up the office and went down the back stairs to the parking lot, where I retrieved my VW, a decaying sedan with more rust than paint. This is not the sort of vehicle you'd choose for a car chase, but then most of what a PI does for a living isn't that exciting anyway. I'm sometimes reduced to serving process papers, which gets hairy now and then, but much of the time I do pre-employment background checks, skip tracing, or case and trial preparation for a couple of attorneys here in town. My office is provided by California Fidelity Insurance, a former employer of mine. The company headquarters is right next door, and I still do sporadic investigations for them in exchange for a modest two rooms, one inner, one outer, with a separate entrance and a balcony overlooking State Street. I went by the post office and dropped the mail in the box, and then I stopped by the bank and deposited Alvin Lamardo's $400 in my checking account. 4 business days later, on a Thursday, I got a letter from the bank informing me that the check had bounced. According to their records, Alvin Lamardo had closed out his account. In proof of this, I was presented with the check itself, stamped across the face with a sort of officious-looking purple ink that makes it clear the bank is displeased. So was I. My account had been debited the $400, and I was charged an additional $3, apparently to remind me in the future not to deal with deadbeats. I picked up the phone and called Alvin Lamardo's number in Los Angeles. A disconnect. I'd been canny enough to ignore the search for Tony Gahan until the check cleared, so it wasn't as if I'd done any work to date. But how was I going to get the check replaced? And what was I going to do with the $25,000 in the meantime? By then, the cashier's check was tucked away in my safe deposit box, but it was useless to me, and I didn't want to proceed with delivery until I knew I'd be paid. In theory, I could have dropped Alvin Lamardo a note, but it might have come bouncing back at me with all the jauntiness of his rubber check, and then where would I be? Crap. I was going to have to drive down to L.A. One thing I've learned about collections, the faster you move, the better your chances are. I looked up his street address in my Thomas Guide to Los Angeles Streets. Even on the map, it didn't look like a nice neighborhood. I checked my watch. It was then 10:15. It was going to take me 90 minutes to reach L.A., probably another hour to locate Lamardo, chew him out, get the check replaced, and grab a bite of lunch. Then I'd have to drive 90 minutes back, which would put me in the office again at 3:30 or 4 o'clock. Well, that wasn't too bad. It was tedious, but necessary. So I decided I might as well quit bellyaching and get on with it. By 10:30, I'd gassed up my car and I was on the road. Chapter 2. I left the Ventura Freeway at Sherman Oaks, taking the San Diego Freeway south as far as Venice Boulevard. I exited, turning right at the bottom of the off-ramp. According to my calculations, the address I wanted was somewhere close. I doubled back toward Sawtelle, the street that hugs the freeway on a parallel route. Once I saw the building, I realized that I'd spotted the rear of it from the freeway as I passed. It was painted the color of Pepto-Bismol and sported a sagging banner of Dayglow orange that said, "Now Renting." The building was separated from the roadway by a concrete rain wash and protected from speeding vehicles by a 10-foot cinder block wall sprayed with messages for passing motorists. Spiky weeds had sprung up along the base of the wall, and trash had accumulated like hanging ornaments in the few hardy bushes that managed to survive the gas fumes. I had noted the building because it seemed so typical of L.A. Bald, cheaply constructed, badly defaced. There was something mean-spirited about its backside, and the entrance turned out to be worse. The street was largely made up of California bungalows, small two-bedroom houses of wood and stucco with ragged yards and no trees. Most of them had been painted in pastel hues, odd shades of turquoise and mauve, suggestive of discount paints that hadn't quite covered the color underneath. I found a parking space across the street and locked my car, then crossed to the apartment complex. The building was beginning to disintegrate. The stucco looked mealy and dry, the aluminum window frames pitted and buckling. The wrought iron gate near the front had been pulled straight out of the supporting wall, leaving holes large enough to stick a fist into. 2 apartments at street level were boarded up. The management had thoughtfully provided a number of garbage bins near the stairs, without, apparently, paying for adequate trash removal services. A big yellow dog was scratching through this pile of refuse with enthusiasm, though all he seemed to net for his efforts was a quarter moon of pizza. He trotted off, the rim of crust clenched in his jaws like a bone. I moved into the shelter of the stairs. Most of the mailboxes had been ripped out, and mail was scattered in the foyer like so much trash. According to the address on the face of the check, Lombardo lived in apartment 26, which I surmised was somewhere above. There were apparently 40 units, only a few marked with the occupants' names. That seemed curious to me. In Santa Teresa, the post office won't even deliver junk mail unless a box is provided, clearly marked, and in good repair. I pictured the postman emptying out his mail pouch like a waste paper basket, escaping on foot then, before the inhabitants of the building swarmed over him like bugs. The apartments were arranged in tiers around a courtyard garden of loose gravel, pink paving stones, and nut grass. I picked my way up the cracked concrete steps. At the second floor landing, a black man was seated in a rickety metal folding chair, whittling with a knife on a bar of ivory soap. There was a magazine open on his lap to catch the shavings. He was heavy-set and shapeless, maybe 50 years old, his short-cropped frizzy hair showing gray around his ears. His eyes were a muddy brown, the lid of one pulled askew by a vibrant track of stitches that cut down along his cheek. He took me in at a glance, turning his attention then to the sculpture taking form in his hands.
"You must be looking for Alvin Limardo," he said.
"That's right," I said, startled. "How'd you guess?" He flashed a smile at me, showing perfect teeth, as snowy as the soap he carved. He tilted his face up at me, the injured eye creating the illusion of a wink.
"Baby, you ain't live here. I know everybody live here, and from the look on your face, you ain't thinking to rent. If you knew where you were going, you'd be headed straight there. Instead, you'd be looking all around like something might jump out on you, including me,"
he said, and then paused to survey me.
"I'd say you do social work, parole, something like that. Maybe welfare."
"Not bad," I said, "but why Lombardo? What made you think I was looking for him?" He smiled then, his gums showing pink.
"We all Alvin Lombardo round here. It's a joke we play, just a name we take when we jivin' folk. I've been Alvin Lombardo myself last week at the food stamp line. He get welfare checks, disability, AFDC. Somebody show up last week with a warrant on him. I told him Alvin Lombardo's done left. He gone. Ain't nobody here by that name about now. The Alvin Lombardo you want, he be white or black?"
"White," I said, and then described the man who'd come into my office on Saturday. The black man started nodding about halfway through, his knife blade still smoothing the surface of the soap. It looked like he'd carved a sow lying on her side with a litter of piglets scrambling over her to nurse. The whole of it couldn't have been more than 4 inches long.
"That's John Daggett. Woo-wee! He bad. He the one you want. But he gone for sure."
"Do you have any idea where he went?"
"Santa Teresa, I heard."
"Well, I know he was up there last Saturday. That's where I ran into him," I said. "Has he been back since then?" The man's mouth drooped with skepticism.
"I seen him on Monday, and then he gone off again. Only other peoples must want him, too. He act like a man who's running and don't want to be caught."
"What you want with him?" "He wrote me a bum check." He shot me a look of astonishment.
"You take a check from a man like that? Lord God, girl, what's the matter with you?"
I had to laugh. "I know, it's my own damn fault. I thought maybe I could catch him before he skipped out permanently." He shook his head, unable to sympathize.
"Don't take nothing from the likes of him. That's your first mistake. Coming round this place may be the next."
"Is there anybody here who might know how to get in touch with him?" He pointed the blade of his knife toward an apartment 2 doors down.
"Ex Lavella, she might know. Then again, she might not."
"She's a friend of his?"
"Not hardly. She's his wife."
I felt somewhat more hopeful as I knocked at apartment 26. I was afraid he'd moved out altogether. The door was a hollow core with a hole kicked into the bottom about shin high. The sliding glass window was open 6 inches, a fold of drapery sticking out. A crack ran diagonally across the pane, held together by a wide band of electrician's tape. I could smell something cooking inside, kale or collard greens, with a whisper of vinegar and bacon grease. The door opened and a woman peered out at me. Her upper lip was puffy, like the kind of scrape children get falling off bicycles when they first learn to ride. Her left eye had been blackened not long ago, and it was streaked now with midnight blue, the surrounding tissue a rainbow of green and yellow and gray. Her hair was the color of hay, parted in the middle, and snagged up over each ear with a bobby pin. I couldn't even guess how old she might be. Younger than I expected, given John Daggett's age, which had to be 50+.
Lavella Daggett.
That's right. She seemed reluctant to admit that much. I'm Kinsey Milhone. I'm looking for John. She licked uneasily at her upper lip, as if she was still unfamiliar with its new shape and size. Some of the scraped area had formed a scab which resembled nothing so much as a half a mustache.
He's not here. I don't know where he's at.
What did you want him for? He hired me to do some work, but he paid me with a bum check. I was hoping we could get it straightened out. She studied me while she processed the information.
Hired you to do what?
Deliver something. She didn't believe a bit of that.
You a cop?
No.
What are you, then?
I showed her the photostat of my license by way of reply. She turned and walked away from the door, leaving it open behind her. I gathered this was her method of inviting me in. I stepped into the living room and closed the door behind me. The carpeting was that green cotton shag so admired by apartment owners everywhere. The only furniture in the room was a card table and two plain wooden chairs. A 6-foot rectangle of lighter carpeting along one wall suggested that there'd once been a couch on the spot, and a pattern of indentations in the rug indicated the former presence of two heavy chairs and a coffee table, arranged in what decorators referred to as a conversational grouping. Instead of conversation these days, Daggett apparently got right down to busting her chops, breaking anything else that came to hand. The one lamp I saw had been snapped off at the socket, and the wires were hanging out like torn ligaments.
Where'd the furniture go?
He hawked it all last week.
Turns out he used the payments for his bar bill.
The car went before that. It was a piece of junk anyway, but I'd paid for it. You ought to see what I've got for a bed these days. Some peed-on old mattress he found out on the street. There were two bar stools at the counter, and I perched on one, watching as Lavella ambled into the small space that served as a kitchen. An aluminum saucepan sat on a gas flame on the stove, the water in it boiling furiously. On one of the back burners there was a battered aluminum kettle filled with simmering greens. Lavella wore blue jeans and a plain white T-shirt wrong side out, the Fruit of the Loom label visible at the back of her neck. The bottom of the shirt had been pulled tight and knotted to form a halter, leaving her midriff bare.
"You want coffee? I was just fixing some."
"Yes, please," I said. She rinsed a cup under the hot water faucet and gave it a quick swipe with a paper towel. She set it on the counter and spooned instant coffee into it, and then used the same paper towel as a potholder when she reached for the saucepan. The water sputtered against the edge of the pan as she poured it. She added water to a second cup, gave a quick stir to the contents, and pushed it toward me with the spoon still resting up against the rim.
"Daggett's a jerk. They should lock him up for life," she remarked, almost idly, I thought.
"Did he do that to you?" I asked, my gaze flicking across her bruised face. She fixed a pair of dead gray eyes on me without bothering to reply. Up close I could see that she wasn't much more than 25. She leaned forward, resting her elbows on the counter, her coffee cup cradled in her hands. She wasn't wearing a bra, and her breasts were big, as soft and droopy as balloons filled with water, her nipples pressing against the T-shirt fabric like puckered knots. I wondered if she was a hooker. I'd known a few with the same careless sexuality, all surface, no feeling underneath.
"How long have you been married?" "You care if I have a cigarette?"
"It's your place. You can do anything you want," I said. That netted me a wan smile, the first I'd seen. She reached for a pack of Pall Mall 100s, flipped on the gas burner, and lit her cigarette from it, tilting her head so her hair wouldn't catch fire. She took a deep drag and exhaled it, blowing a cloud of smoke at me.
6 weeks, she said, answering my question belatedly. "We were pen pals after he got sent to San Luis. Wrote for a year, and then I married him the minute he got out. Dumb? Jesus, can you believe I did that?"
I shrugged noncommittally. She didn't really care if I believed it or not.
"How'd you connect in the first place?" "A buddy of his. Guy named Billy Polo I used to date.
They'd sit and talk about women, and my name came up. I guess Billy made me sound like real hot stuff, so Daggett got in touch. I took a sip of my coffee. It had that flat, nearly sour taste of instant, with tiny clumps of coffee powder floating at the edge. "Do you have any milk for this?" "Oh, sure, sorry," she said. She moved over to the refrigerator, where she took out a small can of carnation. It wasn't quite what I had in mind, but I added some to my coffee, intrigued as evaporated milk rose to the surface in a series of white dots. I wondered if a fortune-teller could read the pattern, like tea leaves. I thought I spied some indigestion in my future, but I wasn't sure. "Daggett's a charmer when he wants," she said. "Give him a couple of drinks, though, and he's mean as a snake." That was a story I'd heard before. "Why don't you leave?" I said, as I always do. "Because he'd come after me is why," she said snappishly. "You don't know him. He'd kill me without giving it a second thought. Same thing if I called the cops. Talk back to that man and he'll punch your teeth down your throat. He hates women is what's the matter with him. Of course, when he sobers up, he can charm your socks off. Anyway, I'm hoping he's gone for good. He got a phone call Monday morning, and he was out of here like a shot. I haven't heard from him since. Of course, the phone was disconnected yesterday, so I don't know how he'd reach me, even if he wanted to.
Why don't you talk to his parole officer?"
"I guess I could," she said reluctantly. "He reports to the guy every time he turns around. For 2 days he had a job, but he quit that. Of course, he's not supposed to drink. I guess he tried to play by the rules at first, but it was too much."
"Why not get out while you have the chance?"
"And go where? I don't have a nickel to my name."
"There are shelters for battered women. Call the Rape Crisis Center. They'll know." She gestured dismissively.
"Jesus, I love people like you. You ever had a guy punch you out?"
"Not one I was married to," I said. "I wouldn't put up with that shit."
"That's what I used to say, sister, but I'll tell you what. You don't get away as easy as all that. Not with a bastard like Daggett. He swears he'd follow me to the ends of the earth, and he would."
"What was he in prison for?"
"He never said, and I never asked. Which was also dumb. It didn't make any difference to me at first. He was fine for a couple of weeks. Just like a kid, you know? And sweet. Lord, he trotted around after me like a puppy dog. We couldn't get enough of each other, and it all seemed just like the letters we wrote. Then he got into the Jack Daniels one night, and the shit hit the fan."
"Did he ever mention the name Tony Gahan?"
"Nuh-uh. Who's he?"
"I'm not sure. Some kid he asked me to find."
"What did he pay you with? Can I see the check?"
I took it out of my handbag and laid it on the counter. I thought it best not to mention the cashier's check. I didn't think she'd take kindly to his giving money away. "I understand Lamardo is a fabricated name." She studied the check.
"Yeah, but Daggett did keep some money in this account. I think he cleaned it out just before he left."
She took a drag of her cigarette as she handed back the check. I managed to turn my head before she blew smoke in my face again. "That phone call he got Monday, what was it about, do you know?"
"Beats me. I was off at the laundromat. I got home and he was still on the phone. His face was gray as that dish rag. He hung up quick and then started shoving stuff in a duffel. He turned the place upside down looking for his bank book. I was afraid he'd come after me, thinking I took it, but I guess he was too freaked out to worry about me."
"He told you that?"
"No, but he was cold sober and his hands were shaking bad."
"You have any idea where he might have gone?" A look flashed through her eyes, some emotion she concealed by dropping her gaze.
"He only had one friend, and that was Billy Polo up in Santa Teresa. If he needed help, that's where he'd go. I think he used to have family up there, too, but I don't know what happened to them. He never talked much about that."
"So, Polo's out of prison?"
"I heard he got out just recently."
"Well, maybe I'll track him down, since that's the only lead I have. In the meantime, would you find a phone and call me if you hear from either one?" I took out a business card and jotted my home address and phone on the back. "Call collect." She looked at both sides of the card.
"What do you think is going on?"
"I don't know, and I don't much care. As soon as I run him down, I'll clean up this business and bail out." Chapter 3. As long as I was in the area, I went by the bank. The woman in charge of customer service couldn't have been less helpful.
She was dark-haired, in her early 20s, and new at the job, I gathered, because she greeted my every request with the haunted look of someone who isn't quite sure of the rules, and therefore says no to everything. She would not verify Alvin Lamardo's account number, or the fact that the account had been closed. She would not tell me if there was, perhaps, another account in John Daggett's name. I knew there had to be a registered copy of the cashier's check itself, but she refused to verify the information he'd given at the time. I kept thinking there was some other tack I might take, especially with that much money at stake. Surely the bank must care what happened to $25,000. I stood at the counter and stared at the woman, and she stared back. Maybe she hadn't understood. I took out the photostat of my license and pointed. "Look," I said, "you see this? I'm a private investigator. I've got a real problem here. I was hired to deliver a cashier's check, but now I can't find the man who gave it to me, and I don't know the whereabouts of the person who's supposed to receive it, and I'm just trying to get a lead so I can do what I was hired to do."
"I understand that," she said.
"But you won't give me any information, right?"
"It's against bank regulations."
"Isn't it against bank regulations for Alvin Lamardo to write me a bad check?"
"Yes."
"Then what am I supposed to do with it?" I said. I really knew the answer. Eat it, dum-dum. But I was feeling stubborn and perverse.
"Take him to small claims court," she said.
"But I can't find him. He can't be hauled into court if nobody knows where he is."
She stared at me blankly, offering no comment.
"What about the $25,000?" I said. "What am I supposed to do with that?"
"I have no idea."
I stared down at the desk. When I was in kindergarten, I was a biter, and I still struggle with the urge. It just feels good, you know? "I want to speak to your supervisor."
"Mr. Stallings? He's gone for the day."
"Well, is there anybody else here who might give me some help on this?"
She shook her head. "I'm in charge of customer service."
"But you're not doing a thing. How can you call it customer service when you don't do shit?"
Her mouth turned prim. "Please don't use language like that around me. It's very offensive."
"What do I have to do to get help around here?"
"Do you have an account with us?"
"If I did, would you help?"
"Not with this. We're not supposed to divulge information about bank customers."
This was silly. I walked away from her desk. I wanted to make a withering remark, but I couldn't think of one. I knew I was just mad at myself for taking the job to begin with, but I was hoping to lay a little ire off on her. A pointless enterprise. I got back in my car and headed toward the freeway. When I reached Santa Teresa, it was 4:35. I bypassed the office altogether and went home. My disposition improved the minute I walked in. My apartment was once a single-car garage and consists now of one room, 15 feet on a side, with a narrow extension on the right that serves as a kitchenette, separated from the living area by a counter. The space is arranged with cunning. A stackable washer-dryer tucked in beside the kitchenette, bookshelves, drawers, and storage compartments built into the wall. It's tidy and self-contained, and all of it suits me absolutely. I have a 6-foot convertible sofa that I usually sleep on as is. A desk, a chair, an end table, and plump pillows that serve as additional seating if anyone comes over to sit. My bathroom is one of those preformed fiberglass units with everything molded into it, including a towel bar, a soap holder, and a cutout for a window that looks out at the street. Sometimes I stand in the bathtub, elbows resting on the sill, and stare at passing cars, just thinking how lucky I am. I love being single. It's almost like being rich. I dropped my handbag on the desk and hung my jacket on a peg. I sat on the couch and pulled off my boots, then padded over to the refrigerator and took out a bottle of white Zinfandel and a corkscrew. At intervals, I try to behave like a person with class, which is to say I drink wine from a bottle instead of a cardboard box. I pulled the cork and poured myself a glass. I crossed to the desk, taking the telephone book from the top drawer, trailing telephone cord, directory, and wine glass over to the sofa. I set the wine glass on the end table and thumbed through the book to see if Billy Polo was listed. Of course he wasn't. I looked up the name Gayan. No dice. I drank some wine and tried to think what to do next. On an impulse, I checked for the name Daggett. Lovella had mentioned that he once lived up here. Maybe he still had relatives in town. There were 4 Daggetts listed. I started dialing them in order, saying the same thing each time.
Oh, hi. I'm trying to reach a John Daggett who used to live in this area. Can you tell me if this is the correct number? On the first two calls, I drew a blank. But with the third, the man who answered responded to my query with one of those odd silences that indicate that information is being processed.
What do you want with him?
He asked. He sounded like he was in his 60s, his phrasing tentative, alert to my response, but undecided how much he was willing to reveal. He was certainly skipping right down to the tricky part. From everything I'd heard about Daggett, he was a bum, so I didn't dare claim to be a friend of his. If I admitted he owed me money, I was going to have the phone slammed down in my ear. Ordinarily, in a situation like this, I'd insinuate that I had money for him, but somehow I didn't think that would fly. People are getting wise to that shit. I laid out the first lie that occurred to me. Well, to tell you the truth, I said, I've only met John once, but I'm trying to get in touch with a mutual acquaintance, and I think John has his address and telephone number.
Who were you looking to get in touch with?
That caught me off guard, as I hadn't made that part up yet.
Who? Alvin Lomardo. Has John ever mentioned Alvin?
No, I don't believe so. But now you may have the wrong party. The John Daggett that used to live here is currently in prison, and he's been there, oh, I'd say nearly 2 years.
His manner suggested a man whose retirement has invested even a wrong number with some interesting possibilities. Still, it was clear I'd hit pay dirt.
That's the one I'm talking about, I said.
He was up in San Luis Obispo.
He still is.
Oh, no, he's out. He was released 6 weeks ago.
John? No, ma'am. He's still in prison, and I hope he stays there. I don't mean to speak ill of the man, but you'll find he's what I call a problematic person.
Problematic?
Well, yes. That's how I'd have to put it.
John is the type of person that creates problems, and usually of a quite serious nature.
Oh, really? I said. I didn't realize that.
I loved it that this man was willing to chat. As long as I could keep him going, I might figure out how to get a beat on Daggett. I took a flyer. Are you his brother?
I'm his brother-in-law, Eugene Nickerson.
You must be married to his sister, then, I said.
He laughed.
No, he's married to my sister. She was a Nickerson before she became a Daggett.
You're Lavella's brother?
I was trying to picture siblings with a 40-year age span.
No, Essie's.
I held the receiver away from my ear and stared at it.
What was he talking about?
Wait a minute, I'm confused. Maybe we're not talking about the same man. I gave a quick verbal sketch of the John Daggett I'd met. I didn't see how there could be two, but there was something going on here.
That's him, all right. How did you say you knew him?
I met him last Saturday, right here in Santa Teresa. The silence on the other end of the line was profound. I finally broke into it. Is there some way I might stop by so we can talk about this?
I think you'd best, he said. What would your name be?
Kinsey Milhone. He told me how to get to the place. The house was white frame with a small wooden porch, tucked into the shadow of Capillo Hill on the west side of town. The street was abbreviated, only three houses on each side before the black top petered out into the gravel patch that formed a parking pad beside the Daggett residence. Beyond the house, the hill angled upward into sparse trees and underbrush. No sunlight whatever penetrated the yard. A sagging chicken-wire fence cut along the lot lines. Bushes had been planted at intervals, but had failed to thrive, so that now there were only globes of dried twigs. The house had a hangdog look, like a stray being penned up until the dog-catcher comes. I climbed the steep wooden steps and knocked. Eugene Nickerson opened the door. He was much as I had pictured him, in his 60s, of medium height, with wiry gray hair and eyebrows drawn together in a knot. His eyes were small and pale, his lashes nearly white. Narrow shoulders, thick waist, suspenders, flannel shirt. He carried a Bible in his left hand, his index finger closed between the covers, keeping his place.
Uh-oh, I thought.
I'll have to ask your name again, he said as he admitted me. My memory's not what it was.
I shook his hand. Kinsey Milhone, I said. Nice to meet you, Mr. Nickerson. I hope I didn't interrupt anything.
Not at all. We're preparing for our Bible class.
We usually get together on Wednesday nights, but our pastor has been down with the flu this week, so the meeting was postponed. This is my sister, Essie Daggett, John's wife, he said, indicating the woman seated on the couch. You can call me Eugene if you like, he added. I smiled briefly in assent and then concentrated on her. Hello, how are you? I appreciate your letting me stop by like this. I moved over and offered my hand. She allowed a few fingers to rest in mine briefly. It was like shaking hands with a Playtex rubber glove. She was broad-faced and colorless, with graying hair and an unbecoming cut, and glasses with thick lenses and heavy plastic frames. She had a wen on the right side of her nose about the size of a kernel of popcorn. Her lower jaw jutted forward aggressively, with protrusive cuspids on either side. She smelled virulently of lilies of the valley. Eugene indicated that I should have a seat, my choice being the couch where Essie sat, or a Windsor chair with one of the wooden spokes popped out. I opted for the chair, sitting forward slightly so as not to pop anything else. Eugene seated himself in a wicker rocker that creaked under his weight. He took up the narrow purple ribbon hanging out of the Bible and marked his place, then set the book on the table in front of him. Essie had said nothing, her gaze fixed on her lap.
May I get you a glass of water? He asked. We don't hold with caffeinated beverages, but I'd be happy to pour you some 7-Up if you like.
I'm fine, thanks, I said. I was seriously alarmed. Being with devout Christians is like being with the very rich. One senses that there are rules at work, some strange etiquette that one might inadvertently breach. I tried to hold bland and harmless thoughts, hoping I wouldn't blurt out any four-letter words. How could John Daggett be related to these two? Eugene cleared his throat.
I was explaining to Essie this confusion we're having over John Daggett's whereabouts. Our understanding is that John is still incarcerated, but now you seem to have a different point of view.
I'm as baffled as you are, I said. I was thinking fast, wondering how much information I might elicit without giving anything away. As bugged as I was with Daggett, I still didn't feel I should be indiscreet. Not only was there the issue of his being out on parole, there was Lavella. I didn't want to be the one to spill the beans about this new bride of his to a woman he was apparently still married to. Do you happen to have a picture of him? I asked. I suppose it's possible the man I talked to was simply claiming to be your brother-in-law.
I don't know, Eugene said dubiously. It surely sounded like him from what you described.
Essie reached over and picked up a color studio photograph in an ornate silver frame. This was taken on our 35th wedding anniversary, she said. Her voice had a nasal cast and a grudging undertone. She passed the photograph to her brother as though he'd never seen it before and might like to have a peek.
Shortly before John left for San Luis, Eugene amended, passing the photo to me.
His tone suggested John was off on a business trip. I studied the picture. It was Daggett, all right, looking as self-conscious as someone in one of those booths where you dress up as a Confederate soldier or a Victorian gent. His collar looked too tight, his hair too slicked down with pomade. His face looked too tight, too, as if any minute he might cut and run. Essie was seated beside him, as placid as a blancmange. She was wearing what looked like a crepe de chine dress in lilac, with shoulder pads and glass buttons, a big orchid corsage pinned to her left shoulder. Lovely, I murmured, feeling guilty and false. It was a terrible picture. She looked like a bulldog, and John looked like he was suppressing a fart. I handed the picture to Essie again. What sort of crime did he commit? Essie inhaled audibly.
We prefer not to speak of that, Eugene interjected smoothly. Perhaps you should tell us of your own acquaintance with him.
Well, of course, I don't know him well. I think I mentioned that on the phone. We have a mutual friend, and he's the one I was hoping to get in touch with. John mentioned that he had family in this area, and I just took a chance. I'm assuming you haven't spoke to him recently. Essie shifted on the couch. We stuck by him as long as we could. The pastor said in his opinion we'd done enough. We don't know what John might be wrestling with in the dark of his soul, but there's a limit to what others can take. The edge was there in her voice, and I wondered what it was made of. Rage? Humiliation, perhaps? The martyrdom of the meek at the hands of the wretched?
I said, "I gather John's been a bit of a trial." Essie pressed her lips together, clutching her hands in her lap.
"Well, it's just like the Bible says. Love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you. And pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you."
Her tone was accusatory. She began to rock with agitation. "Whoa," I thought, "this lady's heat gauge has shot right up into the red." Eugene creaked in his chair, snagging my attention with a gentle clearing of his throat.
"You said you saw him on Saturday. May I ask what the occasion was?"
I realized then that I should have devoted a lot more time to the fib I'd told, because I couldn't think how to respond. I was so unnerved by Essie Daggett's outburst that my mind went blank. She leaned forward then.
"Have you been saved?"
"Excuse me? What?" I said, squinting.
"Have you taken Jesus into your heart? Have you set aside sin? Have you repented? Have you been washed in the blood of the Lamb?"
A spark of spit landed on my face, but I didn't dare react. "Not lately," I said. "What is it about me that attracts women like this?"
"Now, Essie, I'm sure she didn't come by to ponder the state of her soul," Eugene said. He glanced at his watch. "My goodness, I believe it's time for your medication."
I took the opportunity to rise. "I don't want to take up any more of your time," I said conversationally. "I really appreciate your help on this, and if I need any more information, I'll give you a call." I fumbled in my handbag for a business card and left it on the table. Essie had kicked into high gear by now.
"And they shall stone thee with stones, and thrust thee through with their swords, and they shall burn thine houses with fire, and execute judgments upon thee in the sight of many women. And I will cause thee to cease from playing harlot, and thou also shalt give no hire any more."
"Well, okay now, thanks a lot," I called, easing toward the door. Eugene was patting Essie's hands, too distracted to worry about my departure. I closed the door and trotted back to my car at a quick clip. It was getting dark, and I didn't like the neighborhood. Chapter 4 Friday morning I got up at 6 o'clock and headed over to the beach for my run. For much of the summer I'd been unable to jog because of an injury, but I'd been back at it for 2 months, and I was feeling good. I've never rhapsodized about exercise, and I'd avoid it if I could, but I notice the older I get, the more my body seems to soften, like butter left out at room temp. I don't like to watch my ass drop and my thighs spread outward like jodhpurs made of flesh. In the interest of tight-fitting jeans, my standard garb, I jog 3 miles a day on the bicycle path that winds along the beachfront. The dawn was laid out on the eastern skyline like watercolors on a mat board, cobalt blue, violet, and rose bleeding together in horizontal stripes. Clouds were visible out on the ocean, plump and dark, pushing the scent of distant seas toward the tumbling surf. It was cold, and I ran as much to keep warm as I did to keep in shape. I got back to my apartment at 6:25, showered, pulled on a pair of jeans, a sweater, and my boots, and then ate a bowl of cereal. I read the paper from front to back, noting with interest the weather map, which showed the radiating spiral of a storm sweeping toward us from Alaska. An 80% chance of showers was forecast for the afternoon, with scattered showers throughout the weekend, clearing by Monday night. In Santa Teresa, rain is not a common event, and it takes on a festive air when it comes. My impulse always is to shut myself inside and curl up with a good book. I'd just picked up a new Len Dayton novel, and I was looking forward to reading it. At 9 o'clock, reluctantly, I dug out a windbreaker and picked up my handbag, locked the apartment, and headed over to the office. The sun was shining with a brief show of warmth, while the bank of charcoal clouds crept in from the islands 26 miles out. I parked in the lot and went up the back stairs, passing the glass double doors of California Fidelity, where business was already underway. I unlocked my office and dropped my bag on the chair. I really didn't have much to do. Maybe I'd put in a little bit of work and then head home again. My answering machine showed no messages. I sorted through the mail from the day before, and then typed up the notes from my visit with Lavella Daggett, Eugene Nickerson, and his sister Essie. Since no one seemed to know where John Daggett was, I decided I'd try to get a line on Billy Polo instead.
I was going to need data for an effective paper search. I put a call through to the Santa Teresa Police Department and asked to be connected to Sergeant Robb. I'd met Jonah back in June when I was working on a missing persons case. His erratic marital